Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee. And you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. Today, we are talking about Anne Boleyn and Henry Percy. This incident is often overlooked when people talk about Anne and Henry, Henry VIII, Henry the King, but it was pivotal in Anne's life and really shaped who she became. It had a huge influence on her and her relationship with people at court, especially Cardinal Wolsey. So, in the intricate tapestry of Tudor England, threads of ambition, power, and forbidden love intertwine to shape the course of history. And two such threads belong to Anne Boleyn and Henry Percy, whose clandestine love affair, before she was with Henry VIII, of course, still sparks the imagination of historians and enthusiasts. We're going to talk about their story and talk a little bit about the relationship steeped in passion and controversy set against the tumultuous backdrop of 16th century English court life. Anne was the enigmatic and ambitious daughter of Thomas Boleyn and Lady Elizabeth Howard. She was initially brought back to England, entangled in plans for a prospective marriage with James Butler, her Ormond cousin in Ireland, a political maneuver aimed at settling some family disputes over the earldom of Ormond. However, destiny had other plans, leading her away from this arranged alignment into the enthralling spheres of the English court. Then there was Henry Percy, the future 6th Earl of Northumberland, the epitome of the noble, chivalrous gentleman, a figure holding substantial sway and responsibility in the north of England. He was raised within the robust and rigid structures of the aristocracy. His life was earmarked by familial expectations and obligations, but the tides of romance soon beckoned him into the arms of Anne Boleyn, a rendezvous that would shape and shadow their futures. Now, Henry Percy himself was actually living with Cardinal Wolsey when he met Anne. And around 1516, there was the idea that he would marry Mary Talbot, the daughter of George Talbot, the 4th Earl of Shrewsbury. These earldoms were among the oldest and richest in England, and Mary came with a huge dowry of about £1,600. The marriage made a lot of sense. Henry had approved the marriage. But Henry Percy met Anne Boleyn when he was still living in Wolsey's household, and that's when he formed his relationship with her. According to George Cavendish, the chronicler who also worked for Wolsey, Henry Percy took advantage when Wolsey was away, saying Lord Percy would then resort for his pastime into the Queen's maidens, being at the last more conversant with Mistress Anne Boleyn than with any other. So that there grew such a secret love between them that at length they were insured together, intending to marry. Now, of course, Anne Boleyn was not an heiress, and her brother George was set to inherit any wealth that her father had, which wasn't a lot, especially compared to the Earl of Shrewsbury. This was a forbidden affair. Not only were they not the same status, but Anne was still in negotiations to be married to her butler cousin. So the affair between Anne and Henry Percy unfolded in the intricate tapestry of Tudor politics and passions, serving as a prelude to the seismic events that would follow, which would shake the foundations of English monarchy and religion. The blossoming of love between Anne and Henry Percy found itself in the crushing grasp of Cardinal Wolsey. Cavendish actually claims that it was the order of the king that brought their relationship to an end. Percy was sent back home. Anne Boleyn was expelled from court. She was so angry that she smoked red hot with rage, according to Cavendish, and she also vowed her revenge against Wolsey. He said if it ever lay in her power, she would work the cardinal as much displeasure as he had her. Anne's resentment for Wolsey was an ink stain on her soul. His interference in her love life was a betrayal that she could never forgive. Her anger and bitterness towards him would continue to fester, contributing to her disdain for the established religious and political order, and would fuel her future endeavors and decisions at the Tudor court. Many historians believe that it was this enmity that would contribute to her involvement in church reforms and her support for the distribution of the Bible in English, partially acting out of spite against the cardinal. Anne's unfulfilled love and her subsequent anger had irrevocable ramifications, setting her on a path that would lead to crowns, reformations, and ultimately the scaffold. But it's also quite possible that Wolsey was simply acting as he knew that Percy's father would want him to. Percy's father wanted the marriage with Mary Talbot for the money. So, you know, it's not like Wolsey was thinking he was breaking up a great romance. He just wanted Henry Percy to marry where his dad had wanted him to. Henry Percy did marry Mary Talbot in 1524, and he was a member of the Council of the North of England and became the 6th Earl of Northumberland when his father died in 1527. He continued to be in conflict with Cardinal Wolsey. And again, according to Cavendish, Percy took great pleasure in implementing the king's order to arrest Wolsey in 1530. Mary did not have any living children. She did give birth to a stillborn child. And this caused problems between them. They began living apart. Mary told her father, George Talbot, that her husband had claimed that their marriage was invalid because he had been contracted to Anne Boleyn, who was now the mistress to Henry VIII. In June of 1532, he talked to Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, about the details of the matter. Mary actually sought an annulment on the grounds that her husband had a pre-contract with Anne Boleyn. This was dangerous stuff. This was when Henry VIII was trying to marry Anne Boleyn. This was not a good thing to be doing. Henry Percy was then examined by William Warham, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and apparently the petition was thrown out by Parliament and the Percys remained married, because with Henry VIII wanting to marry Anne Boleyn, it really wouldn't work to have admitted that there was a pre-contract. Percy's health was really bad. It's possible he had liver failure. They said that his whole body was yellow as saffron. Now, the real irony of this is Henry Percy found himself in a precarious position during Anne's trial. The man who once pledged his love to Anne was now among the peers summoned to sit in judgment at her trial. The situation was excruciatingly painful, and reportedly he collapsed during the trial and had to be carried out. He did not have the chance to cast a vote on Anne's fate, but the outcome was inevitable. The jury was under immense pressure, and Anne and her alleged lovers were condemned to death. In 1537, during the Pilgrimage of Grace, his mother and his brothers were actually very sympathetic to the rebels, and Henry Percy claimed that his health had prevented him from taking military action against the rebellion. This wasn't good. Part of his job up in the north was to help protect the north for the kingdom, so when he wasn't able to suppress the rebellion, this didn't look good on him. Robert Aske and his men came to try to get his support. He refused, and then he was warned that his life was in danger, and he replied, he did not care, he should die but once. Let them strike off his head, whereby they should rid him of much pain, ever saying he would be dead. Henry Percy himself died in June of 1537, so he did not have long to live after everything fell apart with Anne Boleyn. Mary Percy herself lived all the way until 1572, She was suspected of being a Roman Catholic. She was favored by Mary, Queen of Scots, and apparently was accused of having heard Mass in her house. But she died of natural causes in 1572. So that is the story of Anne Boleyn and Henry Percy and the awful love triangle that got all messed up. Imagine what would have happened if they had just been allowed to get married. It could have been so different for so many people.
So today we are going to talk about beyond the Armada. So there was this war with Spain that was going on during the reign of Elizabeth. And everybody kind of thinks that it ended with the Spanish Armada in 1588, that that was it. The Armada got blown. The Protestant winds blew the Armada. They wound up crashing off the coast of Scotland and Ireland and losing and, you know, hobbling back into Cadiz. And that was it. And it was over. It's not actually true. The war went on for another 15 years after the Armada, 16 years, actually. So we're going to talk about what happened during those 16 years today. So like I said, when most people think about the conflict between England and Spain in the 16th century, their minds leap to the Spanish Armada and how it was dispersed in the English Channel. And this is kind of seared into our minds as the kind of climactic confrontation between the two great powers. And yet in reality, the war was still there simmering around until 1604. And the Armada was just one dramatic episode. So 1588 saw Spain, under the reign of the devoutly Catholic Philip II, gather together one of history's most impressive naval armadas. The massive fleet was not just an exhibition of Spain's might, but also it had a divine mission to invade England, to overthrow the Protestant Queen Elizabeth, to restore Catholicism to the English throne. The Spanish Invincible Armada, as it was called, boasted over 130 ships, intending to escort an army from the Netherlands to invade England. However, of course, the Armada met with disaster, plagued by miscalculations, strategic English naval maneuvers, and unforgiving weather. Many Spanish ships were wrecked or scattered, and England, with its nimble navy and advantage of home territory, dealt a significant blow to the Spanish, reshaping Europe's naval hierarchy. Yet while this defeat was a critical setback for Spain, it was far from the knockout blow that ended the rivalry. The stage was set for further confrontations, retaliations, and a series of events that would keep the nations locked in enmity for years to come. So in the wake of Spain's spectacular failure, England wanted to press its advantage. A year later, in 1589, England mounted their own retaliatory strike, known as the Counter Armada or the English Armada. It was under the command of Sir Francis Drake and Sir John Norreys. The expedition aimed to capitalize on Spain's vulnerability for the moment, wanted to achieve three objectives: destroy the remaining Spanish ships, incite a rebellion in Portugal against Spanish rule, and conquer the Azores, which would serve as a strategic base for the war against Spain. However, much like Spain's earlier efforts, the English Armada met with a series of unfortunate events. The Spanish fleet was recuperating faster than anticipated, offered stiff resistance. Meanwhile, attempts to rally the Portuguese rebels failed. By the time the dust settled, England had lost around 40 ships and thousands of men while achieving none of its primary objectives. This failed expedition served as a stark reminder that neither nation had a monopoly on maritime might or fortune. Then there was the period of persistent skirmishes. Beyond these grand armadas, the war was characterized by a series of smaller, yet no less significant skirmishes and raids. English privateers, semi-official pirates like Sir Francis Drake, wreaked havoc on Spanish treasure fleets returning from the New World. These acts of piracy, sanctioned by Elizabeth, strained the already taut relations between the two nations. Concurrently, the English also kept supporting the Dutch rebels in the 80 Years' War against Spanish rule. They saw it both as a duty to their fellow Protestants, a moral duty, and also a strategic play against a Catholic adversary. Spain, in turn, supported the Catholic plots and rebellions in England and Ireland, most notably another Spanish armada in 1596 and the 1601 siege of Kinsale. Through these actions and reactions, the two nations danced a deadly dance with each other, each blow prompting a counter, ensuring that peace remained a distant dream for nearly two decades. Despite the failures of the initial Armada and the setbacks from the English counter Armada, Spain remained undeterred in its ambition to topple the Protestant Queen Elizabeth and restore Catholic supremacy. Between 1596 and 1597, Philip launched two more armadas against England, known as the Second and Third Spanish Armada. The Second Armada was led by the Duke of Medina Sidonia, set its sights on England in 1596. However, before it could engage the English, it faced adverse weather conditions, forcing it to return to Spain, and it was thwarted without a fight. The Third Armada of 1597, commanded by Martin de Padilla, faced a similar fate. Having already witnessed the destructive might of the North Atlantic's unpredictable weather in the previous attempts, this Armada too was scattered by storms, resulting in yet another anticlimactic end to a potentially colossal confrontation. By the turn of the century, both nations were weary from almost two decades of warfare, costly both in lives and treasure. Additionally, the death of Philip II in 1598 and Elizabeth's advancing age signaled a shift in the political landscape. Recognizing escalating costs and diminishing returns of continued conflict, both countries sought a way out. In 1604, James I of England and Philip III of Spain signed the Treaty of London. This landmark treaty, while not actually resolving all of the underlying tensions, officially concluded the Anglo-Spanish War. It represented a mutual acknowledgement that neither side could achieve a definitive victory. The treaty emphasized restoring peace, mutual respect for sovereign territories, and a return of prisoners. In the aftermath, while covert operations and political machinations continued, the era of large-scale naval confrontation between England and Spain had come to an end, at least for the time being. The protracted conflict between England and Spain left a mark on European history. First, England's ability to repel the Spanish armadas bolstered its reputation as a naval power. Over subsequent centuries, the English Navy and then later the British Navy would dominate the seas, paving the way for the British Empire. The war also precipitated a shift in the balance of European power. Spain's continuous military setbacks, combined with internal issues and financial woes, led to a decline in its dominance. Meanwhile, England, empowered by its successes, started its ascent as a leading European power. Culturally, the war also entrenched Protestantism in England. The victory against the Catholic superpower was seen by many as a divine endorsement of the Protestant faith, further solidifying the Church of England's position and the country's move away from Catholicism.
Today, we are talking about murder most foul. In fact, a murder kind of ancillary to the court of Henry VIII, and a woman who was hanged for it. Let's talk about Agnes Hungerford. In the heart of Somerset, amidst rolling hills and whispered legends, lies the ruins of Farley Hungerford Castle. It is a testament to the history of power, ambition, and mysterious events that unfolded within its walls. One of those events is the story of Lady Agnes Hungerford. Her birth and early life are shrouded in mystery, but her later years, marked by accusations and a trial and a tragic end, have echoed through the ages. Many of Agnes's contemporaries may have chosen to forget her, but the castle walls remember. Today, we are going to journey through time to talk about the story of a lady, two husbands, a mysterious death, and the haunting echoes that remain. So Agnes's life reads like the pages of a riveting historical drama. Her first husband was John Cotell, and he was the steward of Edward Hungerford. Edward Hungerford was a wealthy landowner. He actually would go to the Field of Cloth of Gold with Henry VIII in 1520. So he was a very wealthy landowner. John Cotell was his steward. And Agnes, she's also sometimes called Alice. Alice or Agnes was his wife. So on July 26, 1518, John's life came to an abrupt end within the walls of Farley Hungerford Castle. Not long after, Agnes married Edward. So this was a step up for her. She was first married to the steward. Now she's married to the boss. Edward had lost his first wife, Jane, a little bit before. So the exact timeline between John's death, John Cattell's death, and Agnes's subsequent wedding is a little sketchy, but definitely by the end of the year, by December 28th, Agnes and her servants had made Farley Castle, the Hungerford family's residence, their permanent home. So her husband dies July 26th. By the end of December, she's married and she is the lady of the manor. Agnes and Edward never had any children, but she was the stepmother to Edward's son, Walter, who was from his first marriage. Walter was about 15 when Agnes stepped into their lives. And the marriage seemed to be quite happy. Edward actually died in 1522, January 24th, 1522. But in his will, he left Agnes everything. He had just redone his will the year before, and he left her everything, made her the sole executor. And Walter wasn't named at all in the document, so he completely disinherited his son, according to the will. So then the peaceful facade crumbles, as always happens. And there are, you know, thoughts that Edward knew more about John Cattell's death than maybe he led on, and he had been protecting her. So suddenly these whispers that might have been going around before become louder. John Cattell's death wasn't natural. Stories emerge claiming that two yeomen of Heytesbury, William Matthew and William Ignis, who had worked for Agnes, had strangled John on Agnes's orders and then burned his body in the castle's furnace. The law caught up with them. Agnes, along with her servants, faced trial by November 1522, so it was only 10 months after Edward dies. The next year, Matthew and Agnes were sentenced to death for their roles in the murder, and they were executed at Tyburn in February of 1522. Agnes's final resting place was Greyfriars Church in London. William Ignis, on the other hand, initially escaped justice, but he was caught eventually, and he was also executed. So it's a puzzle, right? Nobody knows exactly what happened in this situation, but the general consensus seems to be that Agnes might have orchestrated her first husband's death to pave her way to a more advantageous marriage with Edward. The peculiar disposal of her husband's body, coupled with the silence during Edward's lifetime, stirs suspicions of his own involvement. Oddly, because she was the sole inheritor and she then was killed, all of the property went to Henry VIII, went to the crown. But within a few months, most of the property was handed back to Walter, who, you know, by rights should have inherited it in the first place, except for Heytesbury. So given the fact that Walter had been completely left out of his father's will, it's tempting to think that he might have had something to do with making this whole thing public and bringing everything to light in the first place. Even centuries after the tumultuous events of her life, Farley Castle holds whispers of Agnes's spirit. Numerous visitors and locals have told stories of encountering a spectral presence believed to be Agnes, especially around twilight when the boundaries between day and night blur. Within the cold stone walls and echoing halls of the castle, many have reported a feeling of being observed or of a sudden chill in areas that are otherwise warm. A particular favorite haunt for this ghostly figure seems to be the vicinity of the chapel. Eyewitnesses speak of a fleeting vision of a woman, ethereal in beauty, who appears just for a moment before fading away into the encroaching shadows. Moreover, some accounts have described distant sounds reminiscent of a woman's lament, echoing through the castle's corridors, particularly on stormy nights. Others have even claimed to catch the scent of a burnt aroma, eerily reminiscent of the tragic event that transpired in the kitchen furnace. The tales of Agnes's apparition serve as a haunting reminder of her tumultuous past and the castle's grim history. While many may dismiss these stories as mere lore, others believe that Agnes, Lady Hungerford, is still bound to Farley Castle, searching for solace or perhaps seeking to tell her side of the story. Maybe there was more to it. Maybe she was actually one of the victims in all of this. I don't know. If you are ever brave enough to visit, please let me know if you see her ghost. Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe. History and Coffee, Heather Tesco, you will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, a scent for maybe sweating. Blow, northern wind.